So what? So we're on to our third track now.
Nice.
Which is the do you have the last page of the story? Because I know that's where I had some of my questions. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I got it.
All right. So,
are we recording now?
Yeah. This is on.
Coming to you from a studio in the Ann Arbor District Library.
Hello, and welcome to Words, the podcast where we talk about words and the people who write them. I'm Phil Wittedine.
I'm Jack Bologna.
And this is The Beans. Today is March 15th, the Ides of March.
And for that reason, Words, the podcast, has secretly decided to turn on The Beans in an act of rebellion.
Wait, what?
Stab!
Bologna!
That was a good day.
Yeah, I think it was good. Anyway, it's Words, the podcast, episode 7. Today, working title.
We workshop a current project of short story writer Abrar Haider, and poet Chris Aldridge reads his poetry, some of which is yet untitled.
Well, this poem is actually untitled. I never fit it with a title for various reasons. Number one being I'm terrible at writing titles.
I had the idea for this for a few years, but I never actually pursued it until just a few weeks ago, actually.
So because The Beans is dead, Phil right here has got his crystal ball out and is currently trying to channel his broken spirit. Phil?
It's me, The Beans, from beyond the grave.
Wow, Phil's really channeling him right now.
Feel free to hit pause, press the download button, and listen at your leisure. And if you want to learn more about our contributors, go to our website at www.wordsthepodcast.com.
Wow, thank you, Ghost of the Beans Channel.
This is no problem.
Please come by more often
on
the show.
Okay.
This is so dumb. Chris Aldridge is a poet and graduate of Central Michigan University. Chris currently works as a journalist for the Huron Daily Tribune. We discuss the creative writing process, the moment-to-moment of life as ephemera, and adults playing with Nerf guns.
Hey guys, we're in the studio. We're sitting down with Chris Aldridge. Chris, please tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. My name's Chris Aldridge. I'm originally from Midland, Michigan. Right now, I'm out on the Thumb in Bad Axe in No Man's Land, working for the Huron Daily Tribune as a news reporter. Mm-hmm. And I'm here today in Ann Arbor with words. So,
yeah, he brought words, and he's here with words. And we're using words to talk right now.
Oh, yeah, it's three layers of meta.
Yeah,
I can't
process. Yeah, I got to work with Chris one summer. Actually, also with Jeremy Allen, who's on the show recently. That was a pretty fun summer in Flint.
But what was that summer again? That was like 2013?
2013, the magical summer of 2013.
I also had a magical summer, the summer of 2013.
What happened?
It was a very different way. So I guess one way of thinking about this very small collection of poetry is that it's a reflection of Chris's 2014 in verse, kind of, or the poetic impressions of a year.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'd love to hear you start from the beginning, I guess, on July 2nd.
That's this one, right?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry. Okay. You could just, like, say the title of the poem and then just, like, you know, do your thing.
Right. Okay. Well, this poem is actually untitled. I never fit it with a title for various reasons. Number one being I'm terrible at writing titles. But anyway, it was written July 2nd. And here it goes. Asleep to see three women, black hole eyes, dusty skin and bone, pants cuffed at the heel, fight to wake. They stamp me out. Fight to wake. Take my lucidity. Fight to wake. Dream instead. Ticking hands hold the night. Then morning. Set the sheets aflame.
So this is a poem about waking up from a dream, right?
Presumably. I think that's what I was thinking when I wrote it. It makes sense right now thinking about it that way, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, then what did you...
This is a dramatic waking up.
Yeah, that's
if you
what
wanna,
I...
If you want to read it in such simple... I don't know. I mean, I'm curious to know, like, what are you fighting to wake from? You know, like, what is that?
Because the poem starts, asleep to see.
Which is interesting because you can't... I mean, you obviously can't see when you're sleeping. So it's... You're having some kind of image or premonition or something's going on in your head, and that's what you're fighting to wake from.
Exactly. Yeah. I kind of took this as you know, as a dream, and this is what I'm seeing. And I just have a lot of messed up dreams, and I'm trying to kind of interpret it. But at the same time, you know, when you wake from a dream and you just can't remember it and you're struggling, it's kind of reflective of that, because you know, I'm battling my memory at the same time to try and remember what the hell is happening, and this is like my best rendition of, I guess, what I went through as I was in one particular dream.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit more about the dream? I know you mentioned three women, black hole eyes, but yeah, do you remember the specific dream that spurred this?
this is basically a blending of my imagination and a dream. If they're battling each other, this is what happened during the dream. You know, I don't know how much of this actually happened during an actual dream, and how much my mind kind of created to craft the poem using my imagination, as you know, in both of them. So,
yeah.
How much would you say that your poetic process is like a waking dream? Or do you think of your, like, doing imaginative work, is that a fight for lucidity or something like that? Is this reflective of the way of your process, or is it just one experience that you put into verse or put into poetry? Yeah,
and maybe you could talk a little bit about your creative process.
Gosh, that's a tough question. you know, I think my creative process really is kind of akin to what I would experience in a dream. I'm trying to battle imagination and balance it with reality at the same time. So I'm trying to blend both of them. And
that's like Joyce, right? Isn't that the... Sorry, yeah, keep going.
No, yeah, so I'm trying to kind of bring those tangents into check, I guess you could say. But at the same time, leave them blended in a way where you see, you get reality, but you get a sense of dream at the same time. And I feel like I do that with, that's kind of the process in all poems. It doesn't have to be a poem based on a dream. I could, you know, it could be about something as simple as walking down the road, and it takes on some sort of, like, yeah, I don't know, otherworldly kind of approach.
So do you keep a journal by your nightstand? Is that something? I mean, because that's something that I do. I mean, if
I used to do that too.
Yeah, I mean, because that's where I get a lot of ideas as well. It just kind of hits you, like, when you're either going to bed or, like, when you're waking up, and in this weird in between space of, like, semi consciousness where things just seem to kind of rumble around in your brain.
You know, I really don't, but I really should, because that's when my mind is probably working the fastest all day, really, because all these things are just racing around, and which kind of probably influence the dreams that I'm having. So yeah, I should probably invest in a notepad, you know.
So how do you write your poems? Do you use a notebook, or do you just sit down to a Word document?
You know, there's lately I've been seeing around, going on social media, people opting for the kind of antique, you know, process of using a pen and paper, and unfortunately I don't do that near as much as I can. I usually just open up a Word document and take it to town, but I really need to pick up the pen and, like, I don't know, maybe a what do you call those, like, quills or something that, you know, with the ink and the, and I really need to get going on that.
I actually prefer stone tablets and a chisel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Need to revert back to that. Yeah.
But no one else reads cuneiform though, so it's very difficult to share my writing.
So I guess the next poem in this collection is, like, it happens on July 19th. It's called Innards. I think I'm reading this.
Yeah. Yeah. Chris, take a stab at this guy.
A stab at it, yeah, I like that. But yeah, okay. So this poem is called Innards. It was written July 19th in the deep heat wave of a Michigan summer, if there ever was one. I don't think there was, but
I could use one right now.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Okay. So the title is called Innards. If I could press a million needles into every toothpick pore, and if by two fingers at a time, wholeheartedly bleed each halved heart, drink your fire, I would.
Damn.
I think it's interesting that we, so I said this earlier before, but, like, it's like a conditional phrase, like, if I could do all this stuff, and then, like, on the second to last line, it's like, there's another person that comes in, and then suddenly, like, at the very end, you're like, yeah, I would totally do that for this person who
but,
just was.
But yeah, who is the your? Who is the you? Who are you writing this poem for?
Whose fire is it?
Yeah. You know, I guess it's in a. I'm taking myself out of reality again and imagining that I have this like this goddess that I just want to swallow or become one with. I don't know. It sounds kind of weird, but
so it's almost as if you're like the muse and the poet.
Yeah, I mean, I that's definitely a good way to look at it. Yeah.
So is this a poem then about your own creative process where you're trying to get what's inside of you out?
Is this a poem about something that inspires you? Because the title of the poem is called Innards, mm-hmm. and so it's talking about something that's inside of you, and it's kind of like you're getting into contact. If I could press a million needles, you know, into every toothpick pore, and it's a really visceral poem, and it's talking about what you're made up of, and I think it becomes what we keep reading out of these things is, you know, what inspires you, and we talk about that muse idea. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, and when we get to the end, we really see that, you know, there's a heart drinking fire, you know, drinking your fire specifically. So it's like, yeah, I'm reading this as like a way of coming to terms with your own inspiration, kind of.
Yeah, well, not to keep talking, so Chris doesn't have an opportunity to talk about his own poem.
Blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
blah, 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 blah. Sorry.
But I think, and one thing we do talk about a lot in this podcast is this idea of language being this imperfect proxy.
Mm, yeah.
And this is, if I could do this, if I could, you know, if I could press a million needles into every toothpick pore, and if by two fingers at a time wholeheartedly plead each halved heart, drink your fire, I would. But it's if I could do that, if language could express what is inside of me, if it could express my innards, I would. Is that off track? I mean, what do you think of language being this proxy?
No, yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't think I really looked at it from that angle before. Honestly, when I wrote this, I wanted to kind of imagine someone I had like almost a lust for, and kind of I wanted to be more than like I wanted to feel them in a way that I wanted to be almost become them and tap into their body and just kind of like experience them in a way that no one else could, meaning, you know, drink their fire after I'm done, you know, like getting into them.
So is there a different Chris Aldridge, like a Chris Aldridge the poet, and just a Chris Aldridge the regular guy?
Like a split personality.
God, I mean, or
persona.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the artistic persona.
Yeah.
Artistic. It's artistic, guys.
that seems kind of arrogant to think of, but yeah, I think that if I could have two of me, that would be the way I would do it.
What's the pen name for the other Chris Aldridge, the poet?
Chris Aldridge Senior. I don't know. I'm not contributing anymore.
That is yet to be named. I'm not sure. gosh, what would be a good pen name? I don't know. What do you guys think?
It's got to come from inside you. It's got to be like this little voice that, you know. You had to keep pressing on that heart and drinking that fire and see what comes out, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll have to bear that in mind and come back with you with a name on that. So this poem was, I believe, December 22nd, so pretty recently, within the past 2 months, and it is untitled. She sifts life through calendar eyes to see past golden fields of whisked wheat and bullshit lines like that. Sure, she'd say, sunsets are beautiful, but poetic verse starts wars. It's not the only value fiction has. She wrote a story. A woman wanted meat, something visceral, real enough to holster while turning her back on a man with a gun. The woman never found it. Her stories always had riddles like that. I'd grieve lesser if she died now than stay to breathe a few more minutes out. Short breaths, hard breaths. She's face up. But there's something about watching life escape with the air through buttonholes of her shirt. And those couple phrases that sway, then fall back to her breast, that make me feel like I'm in an old Western, maybe a character in her story.
So, Chris, you're in a serious relationship right now.
You could call it that, yeah, definitely.
Okay, so how, So when you write about like a she, how does your girlfriend feel about the she's in your poems? Is she ever like, Chris, you trying to tell me something? Or
no, I think she kind of understands that I like to, however cliche it may be, I like to kind of romanticize things. And I'm just choosing a random character to kind of romanticize in this context. So I think she's got enough trust building over like 6 or 7 years that we've been dating to kind of realize it's not somebody in real life.
let's go to that first stanza. I really like that line.
Bullshit lines like that.
Yeah. So yeah, just read those two lines together if you could.
Sure. To see past golden fields of whisked wheat. And bullshit lines like that.
It's like the poem becomes self-aware. It's like...
Yeah,
I love that.
That's kind of an example of me becoming self-aware, I gotta say, because, you know, over the past few years, I've been writing these poems that are just chock full of, like, descriptions that aren't necessary and, like, just kind of, like, words grouped together just to form an image, and they don't really have any meaning. They don't move anything, so... I wanted to call myself out kind of in those lines and go further off of that.
So based on that then, did you write that that bullshit line in the first draft of this poem? And then also, why did you choose the setting then of golden fields of whist wheat? Does it really not have any meaning?
It was completely arbitrary. I wrote these two lines. The two lines are, she sifts life through calendar eyes to see past golden fields of whist wheat. I started the poem with those two lines, and I stopped myself, and I'm like, no. Don't write another bullshit poem like this. Just stop it. And then I was like, wait, why don't I actually include this notion that I'm having about bullshit poetry and put it in the third line and go into something completely different? And that's kind of what I did.
This is like Dadaism almost, you know? This is just like what's...
Yeah.
So wait, where did those first two lines come from then?
They arbitrarily came from something I just thought up and created a setting that was kind of, in my view, cliche and reflective of past... mistakes I've made in past poems, I guess, that I wanted to try to avoid.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we go from there into a woman wanted meat, something visceral, real enough to holster, so it's getting into more grounded, real life and stuff. Which is, you can see like how your thought process was going from that third line into the rest of the poem.
We should maybe move on to another poem.
Yeah, could you read Live It Down? I like this poem a lot. And it also has this theme of time in it. Because I remember in the first poem that you read for us, you mentioned ticking hands hold the night, then morning sets the sheets aflame. And so it's going like, it's moving out of time and into something more natural, like the circadian rhythm with the, you know, the actual day starting and not just counting time. And this poem starts with ripping a clock off the nail. Anyway, I don't want to walk over your poem.
But I do want listeners, so the poem is called Live It Down, which is, I just want you to have in mind... Live it up, I think, is typically the phrase we have in our head. So, but yeah, please, Chris, continue.
Okay, this poem I wrote, I believe it was November 16th, so another recent one, and it's called Live It Down. Rip the clock off the nail, wind up, jump, and heave it at paint puddled on the ceiling. Smile while doing that. Not wide enough to gulp the shards or catch a guillotine midnight. Still ticking in your hand, carves a slit under the fingernail. Everything tears from its seams. Everything.
I have two immediate comments about this poem. The first one has to do with how you identify impermanence. And this is not like this is the second poem you've done that in this especially. And it seems like with the title of the poem, Live It Down, it's like when you're living something down, that's when you're kind of like owning something about your past, you know?
Yeah,
and it has to do with like chucking up, you know, a clock, and this poem is hugely informed by the rhythm it's being written in, because, you know, it seems like every line is written with that in mind. And you were talking earlier about like imagery and stuff, and I think this is a poem that's stepping away from that, and it's, you know, it's living down, it's living something down. So and the second note that I have is that this is the only poem that has featured a shard spelled C-H-A-R-D, which is a variety of beat.
Yeah, wait, did you mean shards?
I think that was actually accidental. Yeah, that should be S-H-A-R-D-S.
So it says to gulp the shards when talking about a smile, but you could gulp
a beat.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I don't know. I just wanted to make that comment quickly.
That's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, shards. I actually want to Google image shards now because I'm kind of curious, but Yeah, could you talk about that poem? You know, what was the impetus for that?
I don't want to know too. Like, is there something literal that inspired this? Especially near the end when you talk about tearing underneath the fingernail.
A picture of shards. Nice. That's okay. Yes. Looks exactly more like as an arugula, I imagine.
Is what it looks like to me.
Swiss or mustard greens. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So, okay. That was a great image to help me out in my explanation, by the way. this poem. Sorry, what was your question again, Jack?
Was there something literal that inspired it?
Well, to tell you the truth, no, I think. This is another arbitrary poem. I get an image in my head, and I think, oh wow, that's really random. I just had an image of a glass clock, being thrown up against the wall and it shattering. Now what can I write about? So I just kind of branched off from there, and ideas kind of came flowing from there. In a sense.
But I do really like in the title though that it is "Live It Down." As opposed to "Live It Up." When did you write the title? Was it only until after you had written the poem? Or did you just kind of come naturally with it?
Generally, I get the titles after I write it, and I'm sure that's what happened with this one.
So why did you choose "Live It Down"?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know. I'm kind of stumped on that one.
But I do like the reversal of the up and down. You know, Group Love has this song called "Hippie Hill," and they repeat a bunch of times in it, "I'd rather be the dying than the rising sun." And I love that concept, and I think it makes sense in this idea of endings and beginnings and not thinking about the past. But it is in a way esoteric, and it's not necessarily totally clear maybe what they want you to think when they say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I just love this idea that we talk about being the rising sun, and this idea that they kind of flip that, the down and the up.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say like "live it down," it just seemed to me like kind of like turning things on its head, especially when you talk about the paint that's puddled on the ceiling, and just this idea of smashing a clock. I really like what Phil said earlier about this being a poem about not necessarily redefining your past, but just saying like I don't care about it, but screw it.
Yeah. Screw it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the idea that I was getting at. I just thought, you know, everyone's always saying live it up, make the best use of your time, and do everything while you can and while you're still alive because you have such a limited amount of years. But I think what I'm taking from this when I write it is that just that, you know, everything is will eventually end. So it's almost the opposite of living it up. Just kind of, it's tough to describe. Everyone tries to kind of like do so much in so little time because they know they're limited, and this is kind of an excuse to just not do that and to just live.
To live without an idea of a clock. I mean, because there's this reason. I mean, yeah, you talk about the reasoning like to do things because we have a limited amount of time, but. You just say, let's just take time out of the equation.
It's almost like I'm flipping that excuse of such a limited time, so you should do everything, and saying, since you have a limited amount of time, why don't you just do whatever the hell you want or do nothing? I mean, that could be something in itself. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could spend the time, you could enjoy the time that you have, or you could rush and, you know, fit as much, condense as much, like, you know, living it up in that time that you could. But at the end of this poem, it says, "Everything tears from its seams." Everything. Everything tears from its seams.
Right.
That's such a salt. That's just
The last line is just everything.
Yeah.
I like that.
And what I'm trying to say, I guess, with that, too, is whatever stress you're worrying about from day to day, it seems like every day, as soon as you get rid of one stress, you still have another that you're trying to combat. And people place so much importance on that, and this is kind of like a let it go type of thing, you know, just like, I mean, it's much easier said than done, but, you know, just kind of stop worrying so much about every goddamn thing in life, you know?
Yeah, now I'm thinking about Frozen right now.
Yeah, it's kind of like, is what you're doing right now good enough to look back on and remember? And it's like, well, what if it didn't have to be?
Yeah.
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 Right?
Live in the moment.
The moment.
Mm-hmm.
Everything tears from its seams. Everything. I love it. Anyway, I'm just freaking out about that poem. I really enjoyed that. Anyway.
Yeah, the next one, though, or?
Yeah, let's do that. Which one do you want to be the next one? We have the Highway 10, and we also have the Ambush.
I want to get Highway 10 in here, because I know we're kind of going up on time.
All right.
But yeah, Highway 10 would be tremendous.
Okay. This poem was written very recently, I would say within the past month.
And before we start, I mean, is this a poem that you kind of composed in your head while driving on Highway 10?
Exactly. This was okay. This. Would you like me to explain that now or after?
Well, I mean, I'm just kind of curious. I mean, because do you drive like on Highway 10 every day? Or is it something like, were you on a special, were you on a way to something specific?
Highway 10 is what we call 10 in the MBS, Midland Bay City, Saginaw area. It's, you know, and I've used it kind of all my life to travel to various, you know, college and work, so.
Okay, yeah, go ahead then. Yeah.
Okay, this is called Highway 10. Above the tire-tracked, moonlit slush, I see as many snowflakes as stars, streams of a billion oleander petals sent from the sky, chased by frosty bees broken from their hives. A storm lotus hovers in the headlights. Along the edge, electric wires sidewind and swallow their poles. Black holes vomit static television soup on my windshield. Staring at small doses of infinity, I look away. A streetlight guides flakes down, the ones you tongue before they meet shivering blades of grass. The ones who breathe and bathe in blankets of the night, then die in daylight's divorce.
Thank you. I love this poem, especially this expression of just driving along and just being fascinated by the snowfall, which is an entirely mundane thing to happen. But in other senses, like, it's one of those very human experiences. There's this poem that I just read, Moose, by Elizabeth Bishop, which talks about, I think it's in, like, Nova Scotia, and she's on this bus ride where people are talking about very mundane things, but then also they're talking about, like, death and families and alcoholism. And the bus stops unexpectedly, and it's just a giant moose is in the road. And everyone kind of, like, looks at this moose and is in awe of this moose. And I saw a moose this summer, and the exact same thing almost essentially happened, where people just stopped in the road and, like, got out of their cars just to look at this moose. And it's this experience that's just totally random and very meaningless. And yet it's something that's so, you're just drawn into it. And you use the imagery of, like, black hole and whatnot, but, like, this, when you talk about, like, the snowfall you're driving, like, I think it's just one of those things where you just stop and you kind of appreciate it for a moment. Like, it's a reminder of our humanity in some ways.
I mean, this is a thing that so many Michigan people, I don't want to say Michiganders because I hate saying Michiganders, but so many people living in Michigan know. They know driving in snow and driving on shitty roads. But this particular snowfall on this night was falling at such a weird, like, geometrical angle or something. It's tough to describe. And that's kind of what I tried to capture, because it seriously looked like, you know, a billion oleander petals were just flaking down in all different directions toward the windshield and in the headlights. And I was, like, seeing so many shapes and so many forms that I was like, all right, I got to write something on this. So it's kind of where it came from.
Yeah, and I love my favorite part of the poem is six lines, and each line is only one word. And it's this awesome oxymoron, and it goes, staring at small doses of infinity. Small doses of infinity. That's an oxymoron if I've ever heard one, but I love, like, this mixture of the infinite and the tiny.
Yeah, because, I mean, the infinite is, of course, made up of all these tiny little things, and I like that. It's just the idea that this is something very small within something very, very large, and, you know, you kind of use the snowflake as a way of mediating between these, like, spaces that are both at once, like, very small but also huge, right?
Yeah.
I see as many snowflakes as stars, so you relate to, like, a cosmos of, like, snowflakes. And then there's also the snowflakes that are melting as they hit your tongue, and, you know, so, like, something very, you know, something very small. So
I think that there's this really cool idea, though, too, that the infinite and the tiny aren't that different. If you think of a single grain of sand, that might be perhaps one of the smallest things that we It's just a very small thing. But yet, you know, sandy beaches or just trying to imagine counting up, you know, the sand on the beach seems like an infinite amount. It's like, I think a grain of sand is minuscule and tiny, but it is also infinite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it ties from the same, like, you know, it's beyond your human capacity to count, right? I mean, if something is something being infinite and something being infinitesimally small is sort of the same, like it's beyond your understanding for the same reason that you just can't understand.
Yeah. Beyond your understanding. Phil, yeah. I love that beyond your understanding because, like, that's, like, I think that's what I was trying to say, you know, like when these experiences happen, like when you're driving the road and like you just look at the snowflakes and like Chris, like you were saying, you said I just had to write about it. Mm-hmm. It's something that's like weirdly it's beyond our understanding. It's so simple and so elemental, and yet it just to every human, it's something that we just stop and it's a big moose.
It's a big moose.
It's a campfire.
Yeah,
it's snowflakes, the first snow of the year, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm fanboying, I guess, a little bit about this one. That's my
yeah, yeah.
And to go off of that, yeah, to relate it with the grain of sand reference, I kind of feel like snowflakes are that same way. You know, I mean, there's so many that fall. I mean, obviously you can't count them. And you can't do the same with, you know, stars in the universe. I mean, it sounds kind of like a lame example. But the thing about the difference between the two, though, is that when there's infinite amounts of snowfall coming, it's so temporary. They're so not infinite like a star, like stars would be, because they could be gone the next morning or they could be gone in 2 seconds, you know. And then there's this, you have this infinite thing that's being stormed down on you, but it disappears maybe seconds later or a day later type of thing.
Yeah, we don't even know if the stars that we're looking at night are even still stars.
right.
And that's just light that's just traveling to us right now.
This poem was written August 10th, 2014, and it is called Day Jobs. Your flesh is on the windshield, that fling and crack of black thorax, last-minute pirouette to graffiti the glass. The steadfast trucker, unable to yield, cocks his head a higher angle, lets your juices run, savors the pop, churns through toothless gums a tobacco slop, warm Texas dust swirls like unglued glitter in a gale.
Unglued glitter, that's a strong image, I think. I like that.
Sorry, go ahead.
That is sticking with me.
Was this poem, then, is it set in Texas?
Yeah, that's where I had in my mind, yeah.
Have you ever been to Texas?
No, never.
Okay.
I'm imagining what it would be like, though.
So when you say your flesh is on the windshield...
Is this a car crash? Is this a poem about a car crash, or...?
Literally, what that is I'm speaking of a insect's flesh. So, you know, you run over like a million insects and they get on your windshield in the summer and they're hard to clean off, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I kind of thought, I imagined it as like a trucker that was, you know, his day job is to drive the truck, but when he sees all these flies and insects that hit the windshield of his car, he wonders if maybe that's their day job.
I think what I meant to get at is it's two beings... performing their day jobs, their daily jobs, and this is like the collision of both of them when they come together.
Huh. Is this also like a reflect? Like, is this a reflection on day jobs? That did you have a crappy day job that you didn't? Where you felt like the fly and
are you
yeah.
the fly in this poem?
Or are you the
is
trucker?
That what's happening?
Yeah, are you the fly or the truckers? Then?
I am neither in this poem, but I did have a. I guess you could say a crappy day job. I was a dishwasher for a few years. It was actually pretty fun, though. I actually kind of enjoyed it. It was kind of shitty, though.
I mean, I was I did commercial landscaping for 2 summers. That was terrible. I mean, there was, yeah. But I was the fly then. I'll say that. Yeah, Chris, is there anything else? I mean, I guess just as maybe we'll wrap up question. So your creative style, what time of the day are you normally writing? Do you normally write in one sitting? Do you normally write one poem at a time?
It's usually always after, I would say, 11 p.m. Okay. In the wee hours of the morning. So.
Do you stay up late a lot?
Yeah, it's kind of one of my addictions. It's hard to break. It's hard to get to bed early for me. So I'm usually up writing at that time. I get kind of my most inspiration then, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, you just write a poem at a time?
Yeah. I don't think I've ever written two in one setting. That's too much for me.
So I know you've taken you took a gap at one point, like a year or two from writing poetry, right?
Yeah, at least a year off, I would say, yeah.
So how do you get back into the routine of writing poetry, especially if you have kind of this irregular...
Well, it kind of happens, I don't want to say unwillingly, but on its own, because I'll get lines in my head, which will then turn into images, and I'm like, all right, now I have to either take a note on my cell phone and put it in the Word, Microsoft Word later, or you know, have some idea that I like, and I'll think of something myself, and it's like, okay, I got to start writing again. So I just had so many of these occur that I'm like, all right, I gotta get back into this.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a running theme of poets that we've talked to writing down their thoughts on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
Common thing. There's a lot of poetry on people's phones out there.
Yeah, 21st century poetry.
Okay, this poem was written, again, in the DP wave that didn't happen in Michigan last year, July, and it is called The Ambush. It's 12:29 a.m. on a Tuesday. A friend, who begins 8 of 10 conversations with, bro, is talking about the ambush, again, asking my opinion on walkie-talkie watches and secret hand signals, vests and extra ammo pouches, cameras that snake under doorways, floor plans, 2D maps, color photographs. He's obtained the proper weapon, face paint, zip ties. Still, we're bound by logistics. Whether a door slides or pulls open, if floodlights have their batteries, if the air we breathe on a dying December night could scale the siding, fog a window, and alert inside dwellers. Waging weekend afternoons to strategize, banging snarled minds during unending car rides home. Drained phones, dry eyes, social life sacrifices, all for future revelry. Because an everyday pulse need meander through fantastic delusion to thicken the phrase through which it pours away.
Nice.
It started off so simple and then it opened up and just to like this huge, a pulse and an everyday fantastic delusion or something.
Did you win the Nerf fight?
you could say that. We kind of caught him off guard. this poem is actually...
So they didn't know they were in a Nerf fight until you...
They did not know. It actually was an ambush. This poem is based on a real experience. Me and my friend, we got all psyched up and went and bought some Nerf guns, to try and relive our childhood. And so we arrive at the guy's house, and, he's just kind of... He was actually in... I think he was in bed at the time, so it was kind of thwarted, but... So we bust in and we end up shooting like Nerf guns with darts all over the place. And we're like hitting random people in the house that we don't know. And, we chase him. I don't think he was sleeping. Actually, he was in the kitchen, but we chase him into the bedroom and he's like covering his sheets. And he's like, stop. And we just, unload on him. It was pretty epic.
Wow. That's brutal, man.
Yeah. We didn't take any prisoners. So.
Wow. You still have flashbacks?
Some PTSD, a little, yeah, it's really, no one should envy that.
So, so we've been sitting in the studio with Chris Aldridge, poet, and we've been talking about his poetry, which you will be able to find linked on our website, so thanks for being with us and being willing to talk about your inner life and stuff, I don't know.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Chris.
Thanks for having me on. This is totally awesome. Your guys' podcast is super sweet, so watch it. Listen.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Awesome. Thanks,
man. Rod Hader stops by with a project he's currently working on, a short story set in the near future about a company tasked with creating new life-saving vaccines. We workshop his writing, discuss the Ebola outbreak, and talk about how to name characters.
Just want to let you know, my real name's Abrar.
Oh, but we call you Rod, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, wait, can you explain the nickname situation?
Okay. Well, my family, everyone has a nickname.
Mm-hmm.
Just it has nothing to do with our actual real name they put on paper. So
my nickname for the family is Pookie.
Pookie?
I'm just kidding.
But don't I was going to say. But Abrar is my real name. Rod is the one I go by, as well as all of its derivatives that people give me because they can't say Rod for some reason.
Rod.
Thank you.
That was okay, cool.
Rod.
Yeah.
Rod. I don't know.
Rod.
Rod, I don't know.
There's a little TH at the end, right? That's the I'm doing. Rod. Okay, yeah.
We actually need really good recording equipment to actually hear it.
Rod.
We were wondering, what we usually have our authors do is give us a brief synopsis of how the story is going to go so that we can have sort of a general sense of what's happening and what's going to happen and who's who and all that.
All right. Well, let's see. This story, synopsis-wise, it's a story where, give me a moment.
It starts off with Dr. Akisha Palta. That's actually the first three words are Dr. Akisha Palta, Mr. White Lab Coat.
Yeah. Okay, so
yeah, the tone in the first paragraph. Not to jump in, I like the tone a lot. It's very fun and dry. Yeah.
That's how I want the character. That's why I want my protagonist to be. Mm-hmm. When I was writing this, I actually had a lot of difficulty. Okay, wait, let me start off with the synopsis.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
So it's a story about in a fictional world, alternative world where people get vaccines the way that computers get antivirus subscriptions. Every now and then, they will get a package in the mail that contains vaccines of them, and you have to take them because, you know, there's always an epidemic in some part of the world, and sickness is rampant in other countries. But in our country, in this particular country, this version of America, because of all the vaccines we have, we don't have to deal with
that. There's no sickness, right?
No, there's barely any sickness.
So did you, just out of curiosity, so did you write this pre or post kind of like the whole Ebola scare? Because there was like that week when people like were like
it
going
was,
crazy.
Okay, so I had the idea for this for a few years, but I never actually pursued it until just a few weeks ago, actually. A month ago, I think. It was, I guess the Ebola scare played in a little bit.
Yeah.
But at the same, I really didn't, I'm also I'm a pre-med guy.
Yeah.
So I take a lot of interest in all these health issues that, you know, all these health concerns that are, on the news all the time. And it kind of bugged me how there were so many people who did not, the people I hear on the streets sometimes, when they talked about Ebola, they were glad it was not in the United States, but they were glad that the other countries, you know, could deal with that. And
so, like, they could develop like a vaccine, and like they could
not a vaccine, but they were like glad that it didn't cross the state, you know, didn't cross the ocean or anything. And not a lot of people, but like there were those few people that really bugged me the way they talked about it, and that kind of gave a bit of feel for the story.
Yeah, because we do forget how kind of fortunate we are, and there was a lot of jokes about Ebola.
Oh, definitely.
And you know, I mean, and people were dying of that.
Blood out of every single orifice.
And that's actually one of the things that happens to characters in this story. The virus.
Well, not
them.
Not main characters.
But
Yeah. But at the same time, I'm also, as a guy who, is also really interested in interested in medicine. Hear about, not from other students, but from professionals occasionally, about how the way a lot of the pharmaceutical companies work is that it wouldn't matter if they have a cure. What they need is a treatment method that can bring them profit.
Yeah.
So
yeah, because they were talking about how, I mean, I remember when when there were some companies that were vying for the whole Ebola thing. Some of the treatment was just so expensive. And yeah, I there's no way that they didn't make money off of, and that is a huge theme in this story. But you take it a step further. Can you just tell us a little bit about that twist, listeners? I'm sorry, but we might be spoiling a little bit here. But yeah,
well, if they ever happen to read it,
don't say that like that.
okay. So the little twist is the company that makes all these in the story, fictional story, the company that makes these particular vaccines, the company that has a monopoly on this particular field of medicine, preventive medicine, where people get vaccines, they pay a ton of money, not a ton of money, they have health insurance to pay, most of it, but the company that makes these vaccines gets a lot of money, and they realized a long time ago that, oh, hey, if demand is low, they're not going to, people will stop buying these expensive vaccines.
Yeah.
So they figure, oh, hey, if we always have an epidemic, if we, not always, but if we occasionally, if we have the occasional epidemic across the ocean,
yeah,
that's, you know, terrible. Have people with eyes falling out of their heads.
So they're making both the vaccine and the virus.
Yes.
So do you believe that Ebola was manufactured?
Oh, no, 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 just, no, no,
my,
no.
My fear is that we have, like, these anti-vaxxers are, like, listening. Somehow, like, some like, some bizarre, like, mother's group is going to be, like, listening to this anti-vax mother's group, and they're going to be, they're gonna be like, this is happening, people. This is...
Oh, no, 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 no.
I told you, you know, no, you thought autism was bad. Like, this is, there, yeah, like...
This is just like the Jacob Conflitti interview where we talked about, like, do you actually think that we're going to have to enter into gladiator games?
Yeah.
But that's interesting because that does point to a pattern in the science fiction that we've talked about on this podcast, and that is taking like the economic, like, you know, really rigid and unhuman kind of unfeeling kind of economic logic and applying it and extrapolating that into such like an extreme degree, such as controlling the means of production, where the means of production are getting people really sick, so that you can sell them vaccinations. I found that kind of.
And so this was set like maybe like 5-10 years down the road.
5-10 years, alternate world where, you know, things like this would be possible.
Yeah, and you said it in the American South, right, in just a random town kind of. I don't think we get too much a description of the town. Why did you choose to set it in this town as opposed to like a New York City? I mean, I would imagine or like this company would be in some type of big city as opposed to...
Well, the company's name being
Panacea, which... what means like a, it's like a cure-all, right?
Cure-all, yeah. Drive from, I think, Greece.
Yeah, they're very, very humble, that company.
but let me think. So, the reason why I set it inside some southern state, town, wherever you have you, is mostly because, well, that was mostly for me, because I have a lot of difficulty separating myself from characters. So I wanted to take the main character away from the Midwest, where I've grown for years and years.
Yeah.
So here's the Oprah question. Where does Abrar Hayter stop and where does Akisha Palta begin?
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
Let's start with
she's female, I'm male.
Okay. That's
a good start.
But character-wise, I mean, the kind of decisions that she's making under the kind of circumstances that she's in. I mean, she's, you're a pre-med person. She's working in immunology. So that's, you know, there's a little bit of common experience there, right? There's a medical...
Definitely, yeah.
A little bit, yeah. I also, in the first draft of this story, there was actually very little character development. The main character was really flat. And though there was a plot, there wasn't any... It didn't feel as if there was any actual drama, though there were consequences, et cetera, et cetera.
Bill was telling me that a lot of the stuff about the main character, Palta's mother and stepmother, was not included in the first draft.
If I'm watching a series of drafts, like this one's becoming a little bit more, focused on the relationships between the characters instead of the twist, and that's kind of part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this as a draft. And,
yeah.
So we're talking about your story, the latest draft, which is, you know, the file name that we have all with us here. And it seems like this is moving into like a more kind of human, discussion. I mean, there's much more about like how does Palta feel about where she is as opposed to like, you know, the socioeconomic stuff, which is interesting, but it just, you know, it's a different kind
of interesting. That, I think that's the biggest criticism of science fiction writing. You know, I mean. Rod, but
go ahead.
Did you ever take Tish?
I never had Tish as a teacher.
All right, Phil's okay. Me and Phil have, and she has like, this rule. She doesn't have this rule, but she always she discourages from submitting science fiction in her class
because of the lack of human elements.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you do science fiction, sometimes I think the biggest concern is you just get caught up in the details or the world you're creating. I think the cool thing about science fiction is it takes our world, or it takes a world in which you can kind of like bend reality and you can explore new things and new technologies and see like how humans that interact. But I think sometimes we get so lost in the world that we forget about that human aspect. How do you, I mean, I don't write science fiction. How do you think about that?
I don't think that it should be about just the science fiction. It has to be
what will this particular person do given these settings, mm-hmm. given these circumstances, given this world? Would a person act any different from our world? So in this particular story where the main character is given an offer to help create a killer virus and basically continue this machine that basically just gives the cure, but also mm-hmm. has the gun pointed at, not the gun, but like,
but yeah, she,
be part of the problem as well as the cure.
She considers going to the press about this.
Yeah. And I'm not entirely sure where this actually ends, because she could stay with the company and make a mm-hmm. living, be comfortable for the rest of her life, knowing that, oh, hey, she won't have to deal with any of this when she gets retired.
You think the story could? I don't think she could do that.
I don't think so either.
Okay. Okay.
So, like I said, it's what would this person do given their yeah. circumstances, given their hardships, given whatever, you know, given whatever they have.
Yeah.
Would they do? Would they stand up for themselves or for other people? Would Palta give up some shred of her humanity for a few extra bucks? Mm-hmm.
So how do you think adding these bits about her mother and her stepmother then? Because so Palta, if I'm correct, her mother, because you kind of leave that a little open, and her mother is deceased.
Yes.
She had a close relationship with her mother, and her dad's new wife, her stepmother, it doesn't seem like she's all that much older than Palta, and they just don't really get along. I mean, the stepmother tries to reach out, but clearly Palta doesn't really want to have much to do with her.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to give you 5, Rod.
All right.
5, 4, 3, 2, action.
Dr. Akisha Palta missed her white lab coat. The red dress she wore now felt ill-fitting, though she had not changed in size since she had worn it last. And that was when her father took her out to dinner to celebrate her landing her first job as a researcher. The other partygoers stared at her human shape until they recognized the face that accompanied it. She could ignore the stares, but not the aversion they had to her. Could she blame them? Outside of the few researchers who actually seemed to know her in the lab, she was not known for passing time in idle chatter.
I think it's interesting that you note her human shape as if it was like a shape that she was inhabiting, kind of like.
An element that I want to explore, because the way what really gets me is that when you think about viruses, this also deals with my love for just science in general. But when you deal with mm-hmm. viruses, when you think about a virus, it's something evil. It's something that it brings disease, obviously. But mm-hmm. a lot of people don't realize that. What it is a small protein coat covering genetic machinery mm-hmm. that does whatever it does to survive, mm-hmm. and there is no
it's programmed to do it. Yeah,
it's programmed to do whatever it's programmed to do.
Let's jump then. So at the end of the story, though, there's this paragraph. Were you going to insert that at the end?
That was basically kind of talking about what you were talking about right then.
Yeah,
viruses and the proteins and how it's just kind of like a program that's not really moral.
Yeah, and what I thought, I mean, I loved that. That was my favorite paragraph. And I was hoping that when you revise it, it's something you include throughout the story, because it seemed like it could be a very powerful motif. And I wondered if that's what... could you just read a little bit of that last paragraph or something? Or?
All right, sure. What was a virus? A protein-capped coat surrounding coils of RNA or DNA that simply did what it was programmed to do, which was to survive and reproduce. The protein coat could attach to a cell body. So it does. The molecular machine...
So that's
funny story. This actually isn't in the draft that I printed out last. This is actually me just writing down my thoughts. This actually wasn't part of the story until...
Yeah?
That's how stories get written, man.
Yeah.
I think that this is an important part of the story. I think it's an important part of the background. Here's the line I really want to hear you read, so I'm gonna bring it up. Like, I'm just going to walk all over this whole conversation. Please read this.
But Rod, yeah, you do have that. You can turn in the sexy voice on and off, though.
I had a lot of practice.
You should.
Oh, okay.
I like when I write stories. Yeah. I often read them out loud and just to hear how it sounds.
Just say for me. Say, hey, baby, you wanna let me buy you a drink? try that out.
Can I get a
this isn't going
chalupa?
To the podcast, right?
Hey.
Hey.
I'd like a chalupa.
I'd like a chalupa right now. Viruses. They would work for viruses. Take them apart and put them back together into something not harmful. Beneficial, actually. They would deliver drugs into the body of the patients that would attack malignant tumors, so they hoped. Maybe even deliver vaccines that were difficult to deliver in any other way, so they hoped. And time would pass.
Yeah, that's something that I really like that line, and time would pass. And there's just something about even the language of this draft is just moving. You know, it's going somewhere, and it has a rhythm to it, and it's fun to read, you know?
Thanks.
So I like that a lot. But viruses, they would work with viruses.
Yeah, and how do you think this motif of viruses works in Paulta's head? I mean, is she aware of this? I mean, like...
She'll become aware of it sooner or later. But the way I wanted to go about it was, within our society in general, there is this one virus that is there, that's there because it can exist there and reproduce and just do well there. It would thrive inside our current society. That would be the panacea monster.
The virus that they've developed.
Yeah. Not just what they developed, but the company itself within... within the country would be the virus.
Oh,
it
okay.
could be.
So,
it
yeah.
could. It could be something beneficial, but because it is a possibility of it not because it would thrive better.
So just to make sure I'm clear, though. So right now, like so we have this motif of the virus, but what you're kind of saying is that Panacea itself could be this company could be viewed as a virus in society, which right. is interesting because when I saw that kind of. The virus, I kind of wondered if maybe Paulta viewed herself as a virus, because we talk about the fact that, you know, a virus isn't an organism. It's not bacteria. You know,
right.
It's essentially just, it's like the most basic form of, like, it's like a code,
essentially.
It's not even
technically alive. It's an obligate cellular parasite.
And it has
so.
No decision. It just, you know, it just enters your body.
It just does whatever it does.
Yeah. So I think this is a story about a decision.
Yes,
and,
it is.
This is like, is Paulta a virus?
Yeah. More or less. That's what I tried to go with the, she missed her white lab coat. There's always going to be, because that image of the coat going on constantly.
She puts the coat on, that's like her adopting the role of the virus then, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And
I'm nailing it in this interview right now.
No, for real.
And
reading comprehension, 10 out of 10.
But near the end, she realizes that, spoiler alert, near the end she realizes that this is the sort of ending that I have in my mind right now.
Mm-hmm.
But she realizes that she could run away with what she learned about Panacea, about its scare tactics,
and tell everybody, right?
Yeah, she could do that, or she could stay within the company,
mm-hmm.
with her white lab coat on and basically be the virus, but with a different code going. She has one of the highest levels of access in the company now.
Yeah.
And she could, if she tries, she might be able to fix it all. Mm. Or at least mitigate what damage it can do, because I'm not entirely sure where to go from there.
I think the interesting part is that her father seems to be coming down with something.
Yeah. And that's always weighing, and that's starting to weigh on her mind, because why would her father get sick when... Yeah.
In a world where that should be so controlled that you can give and take and make money off of supply and demand that you have control over.
I mean, people will always get sick in this kind of world anyway, because that's how disease works, but...
And then they bleed out of every orifice, get varicose veins, and then they die.
Graphic virus you made, yeah. I was just hoping they could, like, just fall asleep and then they're dead. That would have been nicer.
Although, there was... I'm currently working on a different story right now. I'm currently working on a different story right now, but there was also a radio scene where...
Well, there's a couple times in the story when the car radio is playing, and I love the chitter-chatter that just plays because it's so inane, and I kind of wonder...
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. There's actually a part of this where it's like, hi, my name is, and then it just cuts off.
Yeah,
I like that, just kind of like brief insert, you know, and it's abrupt, and then it just ends.
Yeah, the radio jockey, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yes, yeah. Yeah. One of those radio jockey scenes was really great. It was just like not there.
Want me to read it?
Yeah, actually, wait a second. Let me try and find it quickly. It's like this. I'll just read it quickly because it's really short. She woke the next day to morning routine, putting on her lab coat, got into her car to tackle the traffic. The morning show came on with its usual cheery jingle. This is Natasha Simmons with, and the radio voice invited her to, like, just keeps going.
because it's inconsequential. There's no journalist or police or detective or, like, FBI investigating kind of. It's just kind of, it's Palta.
Just Palta.
Do you, and then you kind of take, like, this jab, like, this is, like, the morning, like, you know, newscast, and it's just this inane chatter. Do you think you're going to have a role for some type of, like, outside investigator? I mean, because right now, you know, you talk about Palta running away and telling kind of, like, everybody about this, but who is this anybody? Is there anybody that's pressing her in your mind?
Not yet. Well, this story is still in development. I mean, like, this could go anywhere. This originally, the first draft, which I thought was, which I thought was a complete story, was 10 pages long.
And this is already,
and this is 11, 12, 13 pages. It's not even halfway there yet.
Yeah.
It's got a long way to go in terms of, you know.
Do you see, like, the nosy journalist coming around and not buying into what's going on?
Possibly, but I'm not entirely sure what I would make out of that character.
What? It could be a romantic interest for Paul.
I'd rather not have one of those. I'd rather not have.
You don't want to write a love story. You want to write a.
It's not the love story thing that gets me. It's that I don't want to have a character there that's just there to be the romantic interest or the sex object or anything like that. That character has to be there for something that's not just romance, and it has to be a. If such a character is going to exist, they have to be a really full character.
Yeah, it's not just like a hunky journalist from Ann Arbor. has black hair. And,
It's named Shades McAllister.
Yeah. And, he tries to buy chalupas from BTV.
One thing I really like coming out of each of these drafts is just this, like, clinical, dispassionate, disconnected future and all this virus imagery. Because I feel like that could be the substitute for, like, any human bugaboo, like any bugbear, anything that gets you, you know, anything that freaks you out. It's just the next kind of boogeyman. And I like that it's shifted in context because it becomes this futuristic, you know, world full of lab coats, and still there's something creepy going on. And the line that really gets me, the one that stands out as, like, the line of the story to me, is setting aside a notebook full of smudged sketches, she pulled the image of the virus she had in her mind into her pencil. She imagined each individual shape that formed it, and then filled out the details. Each of its irregular arms seemed stolen from a different monster. I like that a lot. I like it a lot. And the only thing I wrote to that was, nice. I think that the world that you're exploring in this story is fascinating, and I think that the stuff that creeps people out in that world is fascinating too. And that's, I think, if this is, and I think it is, a story about just, like, the human subject, not necessarily a future world. It's interesting to see that human subject be in that circumstance and be in that kind of world that I think is cool.
Naming a character and giving titles to stories, my least favorite part of writing a story, actually.
Okay.
I have such trouble with names.
Person number one.
I should have an insert here. Every time I find a fun name, I write it down. And the best name, like, I have a whole Word file of just names that
That's good.
I'm starting to make one of those because that really helps.
Yeah.
But in all honesty, with Akeisha, I wanted to make it a somewhat foreign name.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did was I literally slammed my keyboard a few times, and then I picked the one that sounded most like a name, and I tweaked it a bit, and I kept tweaking it until I got Akeisha Palta.
Wow. Amazing. Okay.
That's a creative process.
Oh my God. Keyboard mash.
Wait, let me see. Okay, I'm kind of curious to see what names I would pull.
Do they teach you that in creative writing?
No.
Your teacher was like, everyone take out your
It's not just smashing a keyboard. I pick up, like, syllables that I think would roll nice in the tongue.
I just think that, like, this century's version of that Robin Williams flick, the one where he stands on the chairs, or that he's like, everybody's, it says, you know, like that movie where he plays an English teacher. Come on, guys.
Oh, yeah,
the Dead
Poets
Society.
Dead Poets Society. Like decades version of Dead Poets Society, we'd be like, everybody, take out your laptops. Take out your start smashing the keyboard. Do it, you know, and then, like, and, like, the dramatic music would play, and, oh, captain, my captain.
I just want to share with the podcast that I just made a character called Afnadf Ad.
Wait, what? Afnad?
Afnadf Adv. Their lunch hour started, so everyone gathered into their meeting room. Paulta emptied her brown paper bag onto the meeting table. Saran wrapped turkey sandwich and a plastic tub of carrot sticks, a light, nourishing meal when taken with a multivitamin at the bottom of the bag. Before she could unwrap the plastics, her phone rang and her father's name was on the screen. She motioned to her phone and left her crew and headed into the hallway, letting her feet take her where they would.
Hi, Dad.
Aki, how is everything? This is Mariah.
She was her father's woman, but not Paulta's mother.
I'm at work, Mariah. Can this wait?
I'm not sure. Taj isn't feeling well. I'm not sure what to do with him.
Did he take his vax?
Mariah answered in the affirmative, and that was why she was worried. What if the vax didn't work? Should she take her father to the hospital?
Could you put him on the phone? I'd like to talk with him.
Oh, sure.
Her father insisted that he was fine, really. Mariah was getting a bit worked up, was all. Finally, he hung up with a, "We love you." So yeah, so we've been sitting down with the Brar Hater, also known as Rod Hater, talking about his story, which doesn't have a name yet because it's only in its most recent draft form. But yeah, thanks for being on. Thanks so much.
Anytime.
Any closing words you want to say, Rod?
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's really all I can say. Yeah.
Best of luck in your future revisions, and this has been a Words exclusive interview with a Brar Hater.
Listening, remember to tune in next week.
Dearly beloved, we are all gathered here to celebrate the life of the former, the late, the scene of Julian Camp.
He's too young. Also so known, beans.
Also known as the beans.
Guys, we're trying to make a podcast over here.
You're still alive. Wow.
I'm just over here eating Panda Express. Got this chow mein going on.
Oh, that's okay. That's
you know what? I bet his respawn timer timed out.
Yeah, troll the respawn, Jeremy. Anyways, Words is produced in cooperation with the Ann Arbor District Library. Words is hosted by the Deans Phil Whitaby and Jack Bologna. Jack Bologna is the show's creator. Brandon Reich is the director of the Ann Arbor Poetry Blast. Diane Thatch is our artist. And you are the listener. Now, the outtakes.
You got a pretty voice, Rod. You got a pretty voice. I like this, yeah.
Okay?
No, it's good. It's good. Like, you have a good reading voice.
At OMG Facts just tweeted 10 minutes ago that penis is actually Latin for tail, which gives a whole new meaning to the phrase get some tail.
Whoa.
So now wow. Our penis thing,
I don't even know what a chalupa is.
Are you serious?
I don't know. Is it
chalupa? I'm going to search it in the end.
Is it like a fried burrito, right?
Chalupa.
I swear BTB makes chalupas. I swear. I don't know.
The chalupa is not just a Taco Bell word. It means a fried tortilla spread with bean paste.
Wow.
Or ground cooked meat and topped with shredded cheese, lettuce, chopped tomato, and often hot
sauce.
That's
amazing right now.
Yeah. So that's pretty great. One interesting thing for me, like being on this podcast, has been like when we, you know, we just kind of like have to make things up on the fly sometimes.
There's this novel that won an award in Canada about a woman that has sex with a bear.
I actually heard about that as well.
And it's supposed to be like really good. You could.
Oh my God, I have to read this?
Yes. Yes, you have to. I'm sorry. I'm sorry it worked out this way.
We're going
to
rectify the situation right now. What do you mean? What situation? Your situation, Anna. I'm going to make love to you now. Oh, the floor has fallen away. I'm a situation. I'm holding my breath. That's if you want to. I mean, I don't want to push my luck.
Wait, Read this last part.
Oh my God.
This is, yeah.
I can make an exception, or maybe combine the two. We'll see. I really want to make love to you. Please, come to bed with me. I want our arrangement to work, but you really need to have some idea of what you're getting yourself into. We can start your training tonight with the basics.
Sorry, just like it seems like she has to go through an employee orientation in order to have sex.
I know, right?
Way, but that's very interesting.
Well, I'm sweating over here. That's the
yeah, I'm right there.